compliance with laws, etc. So yeah, I mean, just to say that I kind of wrote about this a little bit to you, but my objective here, you know, I'm trying to figure out what the meaning of this conference is, especially in light of current events, and if it does mean anything in light of current events. I've gathered all the materials, and I found it really interesting to dig into the origins of my field of rhetoric and composition. And what I realized, I guess, is digging into all these things that I didn't have anything comprehensive to say about it. And so what I felt like might be the best work here is to provide a lot of other voices and provide access to other voices on this event and generally for people to make sense of what it means to do curricular reform and to think about the context of these things. So that's kind of my objective here. I shared some of the questions with you, but I also want to invite you to say anything else that you're interested in or that you may think is relevant.
Well, one thing I was thinking about today was you were approaching the issue of whether Dartmouth had developed any connection with the Dartmouth personal computer work.
Mm-hmm.
And I told you before that it had not.
Yeah.
And that's continues to be true. And the woman who had asked at a later Office of Education meeting whether we could put the baby in the computer and test the curricula by feeding the curriculum into the computer was Ruth Strickland.
Okay.
She was an elementary education specialist from the University of Indiana. Hmm. But that anticipation was developing about the same time, and it's puzzling to me why there was so little talk about computers. The personal computers really didn't exist or had no particular force in American society in 1966.
Mm-hmm.
But the other thing that I thought about as I was thinking about my conversation with you was the British people came to the meeting with twenty years of the decolonization of the British home nation, severing their or either severing or lessening their ties with the world's largest empire, and an empire made up largely of people of color. And we were in the midst of the Martin Luther King Revolution, and yet we had almost no talk about culture, aside from the mythology thing that I wrote, and that doesn't have very much, and it's not very good. We had almost no, and there was no anthropologist, so far as I know, at the meeting.
Mm-hmm.
Not very much talk about sociology. Basil Bernstein was there talking about sociolinguistics, but mostly on the basis of a deficit model of, you know, the disadvantaged kids had something wrong with them that needed to be fixed.
Mm-hmm.
It strikes me that was an epic lacuna, you know, and it wasn't a failure on just the part of the leadership, Jim Squire and John Hurt Fisher. It was a failure on all of our parts, and I'm not sure why it occurred. Fred Cassidy was there, but there was very little talk about Jamaica as a culture or any other Native American culture or Hispanic culture or any other cultures that are Anglophone cultures and deserve to be treated with respect and to be recognized in the schooling process. Anyway, that was what I was thinking.
No, I think that's interesting because I know that you've done so much work in that, and you had done work on that before and after the Dartmouth conference, right?
Yeah, well, I wouldn't say that I set any records before. We did include some work with Indian literature and Indian mythology mm-hmm. in Project English, and then Native American, partly because the teachers wanted to do that, they were interested in doing something with that, mm-hmm. and that had some spin-off effect. There were other places. The Kamehameha schools in Hawaii were interested in emulating what we were doing, so they invited some of our people to Hawaii to work on Hawaiian sacred story. We did do Black Elk Speaks, which is a very important book for the Lakota. Mm-hmm. And the autobiography of Malcolm X. But I wouldn't say that, the curriculum that I had done was largely the so-called Great Tradition, which was a tradition of elite mm-hmm. American and English social groups. So.
But there was a lot of talk about, from what I can tell, about working with students and their cultures and what they might bring. But you're saying that it just wasn't particularly inclusive about the kinds of cultures that were being talked about?
Yes, and it didn't. This is my perspective. I may be wrong, but this is my memory. We didn't talk very much about what students from India or Anglophone students might bring in the way of the sacred literature or the mythologies or the assumptions of Indian culture. If you're talking about composition, what are the contexts in which writing flourished or was needed in various regions of India? We talked about Black culture, as I recall, largely as a deficit culture. In our mythology group, uses a myth group, began to talk about it another way, it seemed to be almost surprising to the group. I remember Basil Bernstein came under a good deal of attack for having a deficit model. So there was a kind of reaching towards something else, but it wasn't there yet. And that reflects the time, you know?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I'm curious, in terms of reflecting the time, the group that was assembled, the delegates, are, as far as I can tell, they were all white and mostly men.
That's true. That's absolutely true. There was the only Black person in the company, in the community, was a Black woman who was a secretary. And she and Nelson Francis fell in love and were married. That was kind of a nice story.
That's interesting.
And he was so happy about that, and he wrote to me about his marriage, and we became quite good friends there. I like Nelson a lot. I assume he's dead. I haven't looked him up. Do you know if he's dead?
I believe so. Yeah.
I think so too. Yeah. Anyway, that was, and she was. She was treated essentially as a servant, and one of the things he did was to object to the leadership of the conference and the kind of condescension that greeted her from members of the conference.
And she was the secretary of the conference?
She was essentially the person who handed out position papers and took notes on what was going on. It was essentially what I would think of as a secretarial position.
Yeah. I did get in contact with the porter for the conference, who was an undergraduate, who's still around. I'm blanking on his name now, but I remembered him.
A porter that worked in the dormitory where people stayed, or
yeah, I think so, that he was tasked with making sure that you all were okay. He said a lot of his job was supplying alcohol.
Yeah. Well, there was an awful lot of drinking, and I didn't know him because I was, as you noted in your notes, we were living on the other side of the state border.
Yeah.
In a house, my children and my wife were over there, and they were having fun with Bob Forster and his wife, who were professors at Dartmouth. So.
Okay. Can you say a little bit more about that, like the life of the conference? I've been talking with somebody in the UK, John Hardcastle, about Doug Barnes, who he's been in contact with, and Dorothy Barnes, who I guess they've worked together on a lot of things. And I believe that she was there as well, but whether she was a wife in a supporting role, I know Connie Rosen was there too as a delegate. Dorothy Barnes is not listed.
No, I think Doug Barnes was not, at least in the general sessions, he was not in my subcommittee.
Okay.
And in the general sessions, he was not very vociferous, as I recall. Mm-hmm. But I've forgotten what your question is now.
Well, I'm not sure if it was a question exactly, but I'm curious generally about the women that were there. So, you know, about, you know, that this was 1966. So the demographics
okay,
who was
yeah,
there.
I'll go through that. Yeah. I'll say a little bit about that. Barbara Hardy was there.
Mm-hmm.
And she was a George Eliot scholar. And she and Ben DeMott had an affair, and she was quite vigorous in conversation. Her interest in George Eliot, I assume that was partly because a lot of the people who were from the English side were students of Leavis.
Yeah.
And as a George Eliot scholar, Leavis admired George Eliot tremendously. So she was probably, I don't think she had any particular credentials as to working with the schools, but she did have a connection to George Eliot, and she was very intelligent. She was, not all women were silent. Most of them were pretty silent. I remember Connie Rosen, and Connie Rosen was a very gentle and winsome woman, brilliant, I think, brilliant elementary teacher, and I liked her a lot. Barbara Strang, I don't remember very much what she said. And Miriam Wild was there. Miriam Wild was a power in elementary education, and she spoke occasionally. But I would say that the people who dominated the conference, I can go through that list. The list
that would be interesting. Yeah.
Well, the people that I remember speaking a lot were George Allen, whom I had known because he had visited me before. Basil Bernstein, but he was a kind of a bête noir. He was roundly rejected, and I think he tried to commit suicide at the conference.
Wow.
I'm not sure. I was told that. Wayne Booth spoke a lot, and spoke from his sort of generous rhetorical position. And, Ben DeMott spoke a great deal, and he had a kind of a mantra that education should be about dealing with objects and situations. I never did know quite what that meant, but Arthur Eastman spoke some. John Hurt Fisher and Jim Squire were the organizers of the conference, at least as I perceived it.
Yeah.
And they spoke quite a bit. John was very upset that the American emphasis on academic rigor that had developed through Project English was not being terribly well respected. And Jim Squire was more comfortable with the British side. Boris Ford spoke a lot and spoke with a kind of intensity and domineering tone that was, to my mind, not helpful. I don't remember Nelson Francis speaking a lot, although he was behind the scenes a very winsome presence. Al Groman didn't speak much. David Holbrook came to the conference having done some sort of bibliotherapy with students. He was really very aggressive with insisting that that was the way to go. And we may not have listened to him enough. I don't know. I was not very sympathetic to what he had to say. I think he probably was a brilliant teacher. I don't remember Arthur Jensen. Esmer Jones was had visited Nebraska, and I knew him some. I think he was a kind of school inspector or something like that. Mm-hmm. And he had some voice. Al Kitzhaber was very upset with the conference and left halfway through the conference. Because he was so angry at the treatment he received.
What was the treatment that he received?
Well, there were the British people and some of the American educators were not very respectful of his Oregon Project English. Mm-hmm. And he came there as one of the gurus of American composition. Mm-hmm. And also as a great defender Wayne O'Neill's linguistics track in the Oregon curriculum. Mm-hmm. And by the time the conference took place, Wayne no longer believed in that track. I don't know if he ever did, but he certainly didn't by that time. So Al was in a very fragile position because he'd put his reputation and his he put everything on the line for the Oregon curriculum, and it wasn't treated with respect. I felt a little bad. Al wasn't good at taking a punch. I don't remember Robert La Campagna. Do you know what he looked like?
I don't. I don't have. I have some pictures, but they're not labeled.
Okay. He's an English for the disadvantaged student. I don't remember his conversations at all. Al Levin was in my mythology group. He was a high school teacher. Mm-hmm. And he was, I thought, very bright and very articulate, and I liked to work with him. Evan Lewis was a inspector. It says here, psychology of language, teaching of English as a second language, bilingual education. But he was became kind of the scapegoat, particularly of the British people who were there, to my perception. Hmm. He was defending the greats. He was defending the sort of classical curriculum. Mm-hmm. And what he called the tradition. and the Leavisites and also David Holbrook didn't have much use for that, and they didn't have much use for him. And he was, I felt kind of sorry for him. I felt that he was kind of, I didn't believe in his position by that time, but I didn't believe that he was treated generously. Walter Loven, I don't remember his saying much. I don't remember Mackey saying. Al Marquardt was probably the guru among the American linguists there. The structuralist, he was at Princeton at that time. And yet he didn't say a whole lot. Teaching English as a native language could have been a very important topic. The education of people from non-English speaking cultures could have been an important topic, but it wasn't, as I recall. Maybe it was simply that I wasn't open to hearing the importance. Jim Miller was there. He was my former chairperson. He was at the University of Chicago along with Wayne Booth. And there was a kind of effort at the University of Chicago to do something about English education. They had gotten a chunk of money to do that. But Chicago was not in any position to deal with the Chicago public schools. It had no credit, no credibility.
Yeah.
Jim was excited about D.H. Lawrence and in some ways excited about the kinds of things that the Leavisites were excited about. But he also had a very populist side to him. He cared about, when he was in Nebraska, he cared about the public schools incredibly, and he worked with them a lot. Jim Moffat was excellent. He didn't like the stuff I had done, and he influenced me a lot. And he was very thoughtful in discourse at the conference. And in developing compositional sequences that were centered in what the child knew and the culture of the child. I came to admire him a good bit. Herbert Muller was the historian. He didn't say a lot. And I didn't think he really understood very well what English can do. He understood what history could do in a curriculum, but I didn't think he understood very well what English could do. Charlie Muscatine was another medievalist there. He had just come from the Berkeley uprisings in the 60s. He is a man who had refused to sign the only tenured professor who refused to sign the oath during the non-communist oaths during the 50s, the McCarthyite oath in the University of California. And although Charlie didn't know much about the schools, and he didn't adhere to the same school of medieval studies that I adhered to, he was a generous man and a generous education. And I think his contribution was helpful. There's a mistake in my description here. I'm saying modern British psychology and the investigations. That's Ludwig Wittgenstein's philosophical investigations.
Okay.
I had spent quite a bit of time studying Wittgenstein's work and studying with the chief American philosopher that had worked with Wittgenstein, a man named O.K. Bosma. And so I was trying to bring that into the discussion, I think without any success. The discussions were rarely very analytic. They were discussions of very intense emotion. Wayne O'Neill, I've talked about, I liked him a lot, and he was very honest. I think he was right about the uselessness of transformational linguistics, teaching transformational linguistics as a tool for composition, or he suggested that it could be something that students might be interested in for its own sake, and I think he was right there. Mm-hmm. And this might interest you, that, you know, the development of computer languages depended. There was some work being done at that time on the relationship between computer languages and natural languages. Mm-hmm. And one path that we could have followed would have been to look at what the schools ought to be doing with the relationship between natural and computer languages. We did not. And that's still a track that I think could be pursued with considerable utility. Mm-hmm. My granddaughter is doing a dissertation in computer science on natural and computer languages at the University of Delaware.
Oh, wow.
And I hope that she does that. Huh. Wally Robson was a kind of the British sage. He was the only, he and Jimmy Britton, I should say, I skipped Jimmy Britton for some reason. He and I came to be very good friends. And when I founded the Triple T Project, a huge reform project that had $80 million, I used Jimmy Britton a lot as a resource. Hmm. He understood how to use contemporary linguistic theory and also contemporary Piagetian theory in a way that was very helpful. Hmm. The Rosens I mentioned, Mike Shagrew was there representing the Modern Language Association, and he was committed to doing what he could for the public schools. He was there largely as a politician, as an academic politician. He was gay, but he hadn't come out as gay yet. And I'm sorry that the conference did nothing with gay literature, with the rights of gay people in the classroom, or with composition centering in gay children. That's something that was very... Sinclair, I don't remember very well. I should have been interested in what he had to say.
I think I lost you for a second there.
Yeah, that's fine.
Okay, sorry about that.
I was asking you, did Sinclair write any papers that came out of the conference?
I can check. I don't remember any off the top of my head. There has been a lot, but I don't think I have anything from him. Why do you ask about that?
No, I don't remember his being a strong presence.
Okay.
Jim Squire was there as sort of the leader of English education in the country, and very bumptious. He was a very energetic and bumptious person, and he and John Fisher got along well, and so it was that was helpful. Barbara Strang, I don't remember. Jeffrey Summerfield was very good. He had a good education in literature. He was a Leavisite. Mm-hmm. I later hired him to work in the Tri-University Project. And I had hoped that he would do work with us on the basis of the work that was going on in the Lancashire schools. But I later hired some other British people, Charles and Christine Frisby, who were really better at that, but he was good with poetry and children. Dennis Thompson, I don't remember. Frank Whitehead, I've talked about him quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
And he was very influential, first as sort of dominating the ethos of the conference, and then becoming less and less influential. I've talked to you about the letter I wrote.
Can you say more about it here?
Well, I just wrote a letter. I can't say very much about it because I don't remember it very well. But he had written a book called The Disappearing Deus,
mm-hmm.
which was arguing that the teacher was becoming more a consultant and less an authority figure in the British classroom, and arguing as to how that ought to be affecting English education. And then he was describing how linguistics ought to affect children's reading and writing and compositional strategies. And he was very, to my mind, this is a long time ago, and I may have been more riled than I should have been, but to my mind, he was very arrogant in his treatment he didn't understand the situation in American education, and I came to believe that he didn't understand it entirely in British education, as I came to understand it from Jimmy Britton. And you know, England was just going through the Lancashire, the open schools revolution,
mm-hmm.
and it also developed the comprehensive schools, which I welcomed. I had lectured in the old secondary modern schools when I was on a Fulbright there in the 50s,
mm.
when I was still in graduate school.
Mm.
And they were terrible. However, did you ever go to a secondary modern school?
No.
Well, there was, you know, England essentially, my perception is that there may have been good ones, but the ones I lectured in, they were essentially not holding school. I mean, they were just trying to entertain the kids and trying to get them to the age where they could let them out into the streets and send them into the factories.
Hmm.
I was invited by the embassy to lecture on T.S. Eliot at a secondary modern school. And I got into the school, those kids were running all over the place and all over the playground, and the headmaster had forgotten that I was going to come. So he sent people around to round them up, to get round the kids up and get them into the classroom, into an auditorium where I was to speak. And I said a little bit about TSL, and I realized they had not been prepared for what I was going to do.
Yeah.
So I just threw it open for discussion. They said, well, have you seen any cowboys? You know, do you lasso people? They had seen American Westerns, and that was all that they knew about mm-hmm. American literature and culture. And it wasn't, I didn't mind that. That's fine that they should be interested in that. But that the school, to my perception, had no sense of its responsibility to the students.
Hmm.
No, and apparently no strategies for interesting them in education bothered me. And one of the things that I think undergirded the British interest was that with these two major revolutions taking place, they were interested in developing popular education that did have some content to it. And more power to them. That's great.
Mm-hmm.
But we didn't entirely understand that, the American group. And the American group, as you say in your notes, was just coming out of life adjustment mm-hmm. and trying to get people to read something that was worth reading.
Mm-hmm.
So, let's see. I don't think I have much more to say about Frank Whitehead, except when I wrote the letter, Barbara Hardy and several other people came to me. And Barbara, by the way, was British, came to me and asked me not to read the letter, which I didn't do. I said I wanted them then to make sure that Frank Whitehead treated other people with respect and that he understood what people were trying to do before he sounded off. Mm-hmm. And they said that it was, Frank might have, I mean, I don't remember what they said, the nervous breakdown, or he'd disintegrate if my letter was read. So I didn't.
Read publicly, you mean?
I didn't read it publicly, no.
Yeah, just sending it to him privately.
I don't even know that I sent it to him. I gave it to them.
Oh, okay.
I think what they did was to talk through the content of the letter with them.
I see.
Yeah, that's my recollection. I know they did everything they could to protect his fragility, and I respected them for that. That was, I was very upset, and I was grateful to them for their generosity and coming to me to tell me what was, you know, what the story was. Is that your dog?
Yeah, sorry.
Okay, that's fine. Anyway, see who else.
You gave it to Hardy and who else? I'm sorry, I missed that part.
Did I what?
You said you gave the letter that you had written for Whitehead.
I think to Barbara Hardy, and I don't remember who else.
Oh, okay.
Some of the more quiet and less disputatious. I don't know where I put that page now. People, and they said they would talk to maybe Wally Robson. I don't know. Wally. I mean, what was really crucial was that we had these factions. What was really crucial was that there were people with whom one could talk across the factions. Wally Robson was one. George Allen was one, although he wasn't particularly a heavyweight intellectually. Jim Moffat was one. Harold and Connie Rosen were two, and I think Jim Squire was able to communicate across the chasms. So that's about my statement of.
Can you say about more about the chasms as you perceived them? What the factions were?
Well, my original sense, as I described it to you last time, was that there were the Leavisites from Britain who controlled the British group, and the Project English people from America that controlled the American group. I think that's too simple. As I look at this list, I think that's it's a fair characterization, but it's too simple because within the British group, there were people who had responsibility for the sort of bureaucracy of the public schools, like Esmer Jones and Glenn Lewis and George Allen. And then there were people who were like the Connie and Harold Rosen, who were actually working in the schools, teaching in the schools. Mm-hmm. And then there were these people that were the products of F.R. Lewis's training, both psychologists like Dennis Harding and literary people. Mm-hmm. So those were the sort of the groups, and they all came, I think, with a sense that they had something good underway, and I think they probably did, and that they were certainly discussing in the small groups, topics like myth or. Elementary learning or composition or whatever, but they were also, I think, trying to validate what they had been doing. And I understand that because I was trying to do the same thing. And the Americans were, I think, of two groups, Project English people who were trying to introduce some sort of academic rigor into the curriculum to reflect what we knew in the way of scholarship about language or composition or literature. Mm-hmm. Because we argued that we shouldn't be teaching stuff that wasn't true. I mean, that's a simplistic way of putting it, but that was our mantra. And then there were a bunch of people like Miriam Wilt, who were active in the schools, Jim Squire, who weren't so active in the schools, but in the bureaucracy of American education. And then there were odd people that were sort of oddly placed people. Wally Douglas was at Northwestern. Wally Douglas was working on the teaching of composition, and he wasn't very far along in his thinking about that, and I don't know if he ever did get very far along. Anyway, there were the people who were practitioners, and on the American side, there were also the school teachers, some of them still sort of heavily influenced by the life adjustment mythology. Then there were the sort of the organizers, like the Jim Squires and John Furt Fishers of the world, who were big organization men. And then there were those of us who were in Project English. That was those sort of the splits in the, and a lot of this had to do with class. The British were trying to get away from the class stratified schools, and they saw what we were doing as reinventing class stratified schools for the Americans. And I think that was maybe part of the agenda behind the scenes. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that helps.
Helps. Yeah, that helps a lot. Can you, I mean, I know you were involved in Project English and related sort of initiatives, right?
I was involved in Project English and the institutes. Mm-hmm. And then afterward, I was heavily involved in the so-called Tri-University Project.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, I read the dissertation about you, so okay. I learned a little bit more about that. Yeah. But I'm curious about whether, and when we talked on the phone, or when you wrote to me, you said that Dartmouth was kind of just something in between when you were doing a lot of other work that seemed to be focused on K-12 education. So I wonder if you see any influences either way there, or what influence you feel like you maybe had on Dartmouth thinking about those things too.
Well, I probably should ask somebody else. I mean, it was so tumultuous that I have no idea. Hmm. I know there are other people who said that I had a lot of influence, but I don't remember who they are. Mm-hmm. So. I think you can see in the uses of myth, that was, I was put that together, and you can see where I was going at that time.
Yeah.
The write-up of, I think that the people who did the Herbert Muller and John Dixon, who wrote about the conference, were bothered by the mythology group. Hmm. And Herbert Muller saw us as sort of going, I think, in the direction of irrationality and romantic craziness. which I didn't see us as doing. I thought it was in the direction of trying to understand the multicultural world in which we live, and also trying to use myth to test it against reality in such a way as to require some kind of empirical clarity. Mm-hmm. And that nothing could be more needed now in education.
Mm-hmm.
So that the mythology group and my effort to not allow abusive polemic to dominate the conference, those were my two contributions as I perceive them, but I don't know that they're, I don't know, you know, I don't know whether that was the case. The conference had an influence on me in that I came to see, I had begun to see that curriculum materials, even written by teachers, which ours were, and supplied to classrooms all over Nebraska by themselves, could not entirely reform teaching, and perhaps in sometimes they were an impediment to good teaching because the teacher was not thinking on his or her feet, or thinking for themselves.
Mm-hmm. Did you see this because of the reception of the the Project English materials at Dartmouth, or what about the conference led you to think that?
I don't know. I'm not sure. That may have been part of it. Just thinking about what it is to stand from my own teaching and from listening to other teachers and thinking about what it is that one does when one teaches and when a child is taught or listens to a teacher or interacts with a teacher. Mm-hmm. It seemed to me that a lot more of the curriculum had to be in the immediate intellectual interchange and couldn't be fed from the outside.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that came from my visiting classrooms in Nebraska where Project English wasn't working some of the time. Mm-hmm. It came from talking to people at the conference, probably particularly to Wayne O'Neill, whom I admired a lot and whom I liked a lot. Mm-hmm. And maybe to Jim Moffat and Jimmy Britton. Just trying to listen to those people.
Mm-hmm.
And what I did with composition after I got home, since you're working in composition, you know, we worked on composition a lot in the Tri-University and Triple T projects. And after that, Les Whip, I don't know if you know him or know of him, he's a colleague of mine. He worked in the National Writing Project, and he spun that out of the Project English, and it became the best of the National Writing Project projects. Mm-hmm. According to the evaluators. He worked a lot on a kind of beginning with the student and beginning with the student's world, and spent a lot of time not only on understanding students and understanding how students write, but on publishing their writing and editing it and distributing it and making it, monitoring the transition from private to public. And I think that was really important work. He never tried to publish, but he was an incredible leader in composition, and that composition work is still going on. That came out of Project English and the Triple D project, and still goes.
Mm-hmm.
So, And that I influence a lot of this. There's no question about that. And I think the directions we took probably wouldn't have developed without Dartmouth being part of it.
The directions you took in terms of centering student work and how they write, you mean?
Well, centering not only on how they write, but centering it on their worldview, their picture of reality, the folklore they bring to school, the myths they bring to school, the religious culture they bring to school, the assumptions about other people and other cultures they bring to school, the sense of verification, how they verify things that they bring to school. Those were things that we emphasized, and not on how, not only on how they write, but how they think, translate the verification project process into prose, prose and poetry. I don't know if that makes any sense to you.
No, I think so. I think that makes sense. I wonder if you can say more about, I mean, one of the interesting things about the conference is, and your own work too, is that it's bridging K-12 and college teaching, which I think is sometimes hard to do outside of English departments. National Writing Project does that and things like that, although at Pitt now that's in the education school. Can you say more about like how that was working, like how the college or was there a college high school kind of divide, or how people were talking across those things at Dartmouth?
You mean at Dartmouth or in Nebraska?
Well, at Dartmouth, but then how that influenced later, or
I can speak to that. First in Nebraska in Project English, one of the great accomplishments of Project English is that we did form a genuine intellectual community of hundreds of teachers that were writing curriculum and writing for Project English, or writing variations of the Project English curricula for as adapting them to their own needs. And that still goes on, of teachers that are, I'm thinking of a teacher named Sharon Bishop, who's probably pretty close to retirement, who's a Mennonite and teaches in a Mennonite community in Nebraska, and works with several other teachers on the history of that community and writing, you know, doing serious research work on what their lives have been, and there's a historian in that community who teaches in the schools who's doing the same kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So and we had summer institutes and year-long institutes through which that kind of work was facilitated. Mm-hmm. And I feel that we started out with me and my colleagues as authority figures, but that didn't last very long. I mean, the teachers became, because they were the practitioners, became the authority figures, and where Project English worked, it worked because they took over. Mm-hmm. So that when I came to Dartmouth, I didn't feel first of all, there weren't enough teachers. There weren't enough school teachers at Dartmouth. Mm-hmm. And there were not enough of them who were aggressive or willing to talk, so that it tended to be dominated by the David Holbrooks of the world and the Boris Fords and the Jim Squires. Maybe the Paul Olsons, I hope not. But and so I don't think there was a sense of division between the teachers, the school teachers, and the college intellectuals that was very deep. I mean, the ideological differences were far deeper than the school. I mean, there were people like Harold Rosen who had been a college teacher and whose wife was a school teacher. Mm-hmm. Or there are people like Jimmy Britton who works in the schools all the time. I'm sure that Jimmy knows the schools as well, did know the schools as well as any school teacher. Mm-hmm. And so, but there were not enough Al Lavins there, you know. And this was kind of too bad because this was about the same time as Herb Cole was writing 36 Children and John Holt was writing How Children Fail. And we have people who were apparently brilliant teachers, but also did informal ethnographies in their classrooms that were very illuminating. And we didn't have enough of that, at least in my perception. I don't know what other people have told you. But has anyone talked about that with you?
No, I haven't talked with anybody else yet. I'm hoping to talk with a couple of the British participants. But I've been working with John Hardcastle there, who may end up being the one who talks to them.
Okay.
So he passes on notes.
What other American participants have you talked to? Am I the only one alive?
You're the only one I've talked to.
Okay.
You might be the only one left.
Okay. I was at a conference where some woman had decided I was a great hero and she wanted me to talk. And she was very lionizing. Which I don't think was particularly helpful, but Al Grohman was there and Don Tuttle was there. Don Tuttle was the Office of Education contact with all of this work. Mm-hmm. And I don't remember who else that was part of the Dartmouth Conference. There were some Dartmouth Conference people there. Al Grohman, do you know if he's still alive?
I don't.
He's a very nice man. I'm sure he would have good insights. Huh. And he wasn't a bully.
I saw Wayne O'Neill just passed away this spring.
Oh, he did.
Yeah.
Wayne was a very, he went on to teach at the Harvard School of Education. And I stayed in touch with him a little bit. Mm-hmm. I don't know if he continued to work with the schools, but he was a very insightful person. Mm-hmm. It's too bad you didn't get to interview him.
I know. I wish I had. I know he was very critical of the seminar and publicly critical of the seminar. I'm curious what you thought of that, or if you.
What I knew of his criticism.
Mm-hmm.
No, after the seminar was over, I didn't pay any attention to it.
Yeah. He and Bertoff were both critical of it, but he was critical of it along the lines of some Project English questions.
What was it? Do you remember what his criticism was?
I'd have to look it up. I could share it with you via email if you want, give you a little summary. But he felt it hadn't gone as far as it could have in a lot of ways, which is maybe, you know, what I've seen from other accounts.
Well,
too.
That's what I would say also.
Yeah.
That it you know, you needed to have too much of what was discussed was not discussed in a way that would lead to thoughtful conclusions. I think it was too polemical, and there was not a process for laying out the evidence, for identifying a problem, laying out the evidence, and coming to a conclusion or alternative conclusions. Mm-hmm. That if you look at the books that were written out of Dartmouth, that isn't there.
Mm-hmm.
At least
the process or the for laying out evidence and coming to conclusions, you mean?
The process of laying out, the process of identifying a problem. I mean, mythology is not a problem. Our group was a myth group. We were supposed to talk about myth. Well, that's too vaguely defined. Mm-hmm. To my mind, and that's the kind of thing that could occupy 100 years of discussion. What we ought to be doing with the multiple myths that are at large in the world, in the school world.
Mm-hmm.
It seemed to me that a more fruitful process might have been to lay out a problem, since we were there together for a month, to lay out a series of problems that were central in British public school education. Try to lay out before the meeting some of the empirical evidence that bore on the issue, and then to have a discussion about what we're going to do about it. For instance, the disadvantage, the idea that there's a culture of disadvantage in the schools was a major topic.
Mm-hmm.
Linguistic disadvantage, that was part of Basil Bernstein's assumption. That was a lot of the assumption that undergirded Head Start in the United States at that time. We never asked the question, is there such a culture? What's the evidence for such a culture? Mm-hmm. What does it mean? What are the alternative views of the cultures that are described as disadvantaged cultures and of their linguistic facility?
Mm-hmm.
How do we use what the culture brings to the school, either in the way of disadvantage or in the way of advantage, to inspire growth and facility with the English language?
Mm-hmm.
That kind of discussion, at least I don't believe it happened.
You said epic lacuna earlier. I like that as a way of describing that. It's interesting. So what do you think, what do you think that the interesting thing is, perhaps it didn't go far enough, right? And there were a lot of things that were not talked about at the conference. And yet a lot of people cite it as being incredibly important and influential in a number of ways. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think there are two reasons. One, if you'd gotten that group together, if they'd come up with recipes for making apple pie, they were so powerful, and that group was an extremely powerful group in English and English education. If they had written down the Gettysburg Address as their pronouncement, it would have been influential. People would have found a way to make it influential.
Mm-hmm.
That's the one thing. The other reason it was influential, I think, was that both cultures were at a convergence, at a turning point. The culture of the English grammar school was at least partially being abandoned, and the English class system and the English colonial system on their side. On our side, the culture of anything goes so long as we keep them entertained, of life adjustment, was coming under extreme criticism, partly because of a national security debate that was going on with respect to the lack of rigor in the public schools. I should tell you something which you'll find interesting. Mm-hmm. That debate began, I think, largely with Hyman Rickover and his critique of the public schools in the United States as lacking rigor. Hyman Rickover was the man who invented the first nuclear submarine. His daughter lives in Lincoln, Nebraska. His granddaughter is one of my closest friends and most brilliant. She's a student of Jewish and Islamic religion, and she knows both Arabic and Hebrew, and one of my closest friends. So it's kind of ironic. Anyway, it was, I think, the national, you know, the Project English money began with the national interest in the teaching of English, and the claim was that national security was in jeopardy if we didn't have better English education. Mm-hmm. Which is seems to me a little dubious.
Well, this is where it's connected to the funding that went towards basic programming at Dartmouth, these like big funding initiatives that happened in the 1960s that were related to National Defense Fund and, you know, things like that. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I can't see that there is any immediate nexus. There may be Jim Squire or some of the big shots. I was, after all, small fry. I was, you know, I was 36 years old. I wasn't a gray eminence. I'd had some success with Project English. I didn't have any money. I remembered I told the group they were arguing about the dangers of having this kind of political power where there was a mandated curriculum, and I told the group, I said, I don't have any power in Nebraska. I'm not an authority. I'm not an authority figure. Other people are doing this stuff. And Glenn Lewis said, well, he was very glad I didn't have any power. And he said that in a generous way. I mean, that was not out of malice. But why it's influential, I think it's because we had to deal with this, the issue of, we had to deal with the issues that were raised by what was happening in, we had to start to deal with issues of what was happening in America and what was happening in the British Empire or in the former empire. And Wayne O'Neill is absolutely right. We spent a month and we could have gotten a lot more done. We should have gone a lot further. Maybe what we did was enough to get us off dead center and to start us in new directions. I think that may be it.
Mm-hmm. Let's see that. A lot of people seem to have had different takeaways from it. But there was, looks like, I don't know if you knew the, I can share this with you, a list of 11 principles that were agreed on from it, including the centrality of pupils exploring, extending, and shaping experiences in the English classroom, urgency of developing classroom approaches stressing vital, creative, dramatic involvement of children and young people in language experiences.
Can you put that up? Maybe I can see it.
Yeah. I can send this to you too, send you pictures of it. But it's
Where does it come from?
This is from the Carnegie Archives, and.
But who wrote it?
I don't know. It's a press release, and it's not signed, and it doesn't have. It just says for release at any time, September 26, 1966, and it doesn't have. Actually, it's from Jim Squire.
That's what I was going to say. Jim Squire wrote that.
Yeah.
And Jim Squire put in that what he wanted. I don't think that has much to do with what the conference said.
Oh, that's interesting.
I'm not saying that he's lying, but I'm just saying that was what he took away.
Part of a report. Yeah, so what, at the end of the conference, was there some sort of consensus or discussion of things that people seem to come together on?
No. I would say no. And I think if you look at Herbert Muller's and John Dixon's thing, There were some consensus as to the issues. I think that was very helpful. Maybe that's what it was for, as a program to identify the issues. Mm-hmm. But we didn't deal deeply enough with the issues of race and culture. There was not, you know, we didn't have a discussion where we said, well, what do we agree on? What are the 9 things we agree? And after the conference, I think I remember that press release, because after the conference, I wrote and said, we never did have a discussion of what we agree on. And I said, I refuse to have my name put to something that I haven't seen. Huh. And he wrote back, and I've forgotten what he wrote back, but I think he wasn't pleased with that.
Yeah.
But then they developed this process to publish the papers that were written in the various groups, mm-hmm. which I think was a constructive way of sort of addressing what the outcomes of the conference were. When people say the conference was incredibly influential, what are they saying?
Well, one of the things that, you know, I've been talking to different generations of scholars. So, you know, for instance, Dave Bartholomew, who's my colleague here, maybe somebody you've heard of in composition, but, you know, talked about it being important for supporting research professionalizing the field of composition, that it was a space to think about the professionalizing the teaching of writing and how we might think about it more rigorously moving forward, which I thought was interesting. You know, a lot of people, go ahead.
Well, I was wondering if that came out of compositions in the composition subgroup.
Could be.
I don't know.
I mean, you know, it might be a different way of saying what you've said, in terms of there was a moment for really important people to get together to consider issues of teaching English. That,
well, there was, I mean, they may be, your colleague may also be, I mean, there was a, there was a movement writing up to that time, at least in Nebraska, had largely been teaching usage and the teacher doing editing of the students. Mm-hmm. So the parts of invention and disposition, as opposed to doing the final draft, mm-hmm. were not very carefully considered. Mm-hmm. But there was a movement that was independent of Dartmouth to get rid of the textbooks that dealt with nothing but grammar and usage, and to use various rhetorics and various modes of inspiring writing, mm-hmm. as a basis for teaching. And it may be that process was rendered more rigorous by Dartmouth. Mm-hmm. I didn't perceive that. I think you need to look into what the composition group was doing, and mm-hmm. And also look do you know if Wally Douglas is still alive?
I'm not sure about him. I could look and see. I think I know John Dixon and Douglas Barnes are.
There, John Dixon is. Talk to them.
Yeah.
Jim Moffat is still alive, talk to him. I think he went off in his own direction. Mm-hmm. But that he might be worth talking to. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to see who were the leaders in the discussion of composition.
Mm-hmm. Can look at more at what they've published too. I think it's just interesting to see everybody's different take on it. It was a conference of a lot of different people who came to it with certain ideas and came away with slightly different ideas, but certainly different interpretations of what the conference was.
Yeah, well, that partly depended on, there were the large group discussions, mm-hmm. and then there were the various committees that produced these little booklets that came out of the conference. Mm-hmm. And then there was the stuff that went off on at the dormitory. Mm-hmm. With the drinking and the and the whatever the hairy things were that went on there, so and I'm not sure which part inspired a different direction. I can say that I came away not only with the things I said, but with a will to try to use people like Jimmy Britton and Jeffrey Summerfield and the Lancashire Infant Schools as resources in the reform work I was doing. Mm-hmm.
And this, maybe this was one of the important things too, as you said, that this was a gathering of so many important people, right? And a lot of, as far as I can tell, a lot of the Americans didn't know each other ahead of time. The Brits seemed to have, many of them knew each other.
Most of them knew each other because most of them were Leavisites.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But you didn't know a lot of the American participants before this?
No, I knew Al Kitzhaber. Let me see. I knew John Hurt Fisher because he had wanted me to come to Duke as a medievalist. Hmm. And I knew Jim Squire because he'd been out to Nebraska a number of times.
And it seems
I think I had met Nelson Francis, although I'm not sure. That's about it.
Okay. But it seems like you had some communication with many of the participants later than after you had met them.
Somewhat. Mm-hmm. Somewhat, although not a whole lot of them. I interacted with the people I mentioned and with Wayne Booth quite a bit. Mm-hmm. And with Wayne O'Neill wanted me to come to Harvard to be dean of the School of Education later on, but that didn't have anything to do. It had to do with academic politics. It didn't have anything to do with that's the people that I interact with.
I'm losing you.
Interact with the problem.
Hi.
Hi, are you back?
Yes, I am. Sorry about that.
Okay. Let me go through these questions that you gave me.
I think you've addressed most of them, but if there are other things that you want to...
I'll go through them. I'll just look at them. How were you invited to join the seminar? I don't know, except... I know that Al Kitzhaber was surprised that I was invited, so apparently I was trying to come lately to the seminar. When I first came, he said, "Oh, you're here. I thought you weren't going to be invited." I thought you weren't supposed to be invited, I think he said. Anyway, it was an indication that somewhere in the inner sanctum I had gotten a black rock, and then somebody had decided that the black rock wasn't appropriate.
That's interesting. Why do you think you might have gotten that?
I have no idea.
It's interesting. Somewhere in the, I should look, I have from the original proposal a list of the people who they had originally thought they might invite. I don't remember if you were on that list or not.
Well, I probably wasn't enough of a gray eminence. I wasn't a big shot. I was. And Nebraska wasn't big on the map. It may have been that the list was drawn up. John Fisher probably would have wanted me invited because I think he liked the work I was doing. Mm-hmm.
You received a letter of invitation and.
Yeah, and I don't have any of those documents.
Yeah. Somebody might.
There were no non-white delegates or no consultants, mm-hmm. and no non-native English speakers, so far as I know. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm singing one tune the whole time about what was good about the conference and what wasn't good about the conference. High school teachers were there, but not very, very prominent. Mm-hmm. The role of British versus American delegates, I think I've spoken of pretty much. Yeah. The tenor, generally, I've spoken of. Mm-hmm. Notable interactions or incidents do you remember from the seminar? Well, I remember notable interactions were the attacks on Glenn Lewis, which seemed to me to be uncivil. Mm-hmm. The attacks on Basil Bernstein and the emotionalism of those attacks, which I thought might well have had an anti-Semitic overtone, but I didn't know the people well enough to know what their, you know, I remember Ben DeMott rising to the occasion and perorating almost daily on the fact that English education dealt with objects and situations. And I remember the Frank Whitehead letter. Those are the main things I remember. I remember Al Kitzhaber's going home. Mm. What role has the Dartmouth Seminar played in your scholarly formation? I've described that pretty well. Yeah. What legacy do you think it has had for others? Or for the field of rhetoric and composition, or writing studies generally, either in the UK or the US or elsewhere. Well, insofar as the National Writing Project had a division here in Nebraska, in the Nebraska Writing Project, and Les Whip, who was the leader of the Nebraska Writing Project, was also a member of the Triple T. After I came back from Dartmouth, it had a lot of influence on how that project went and how it's continued. Mm-hmm. There are a very, very large number of composition students who have come out of Nebraska. Mm-hmm. The composition program is very strong here. Mm-hmm. And I think that probably happened. Dudley Bailey, who was my chair at the time of Dartmouth, had no interest in composition as a separate discipline. And so it may be that the writing project and the change in leadership of the chair had an effect on the development of writing scholarship at Nebraska, which I think does have some, I mean, it's probably the largest program in our department now. Hmm.
The director of it, Stacy Waite, I think she's the current director, was a Pitt graduate. We overlapped here.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, I have no particular, Robert Brooks is a friend of mine and he's been influenced by me quite a bit, but otherwise I don't think I have any particular influence on that, except that, you know, what we laid down in the 60s mm-hmm. still has some influence. Mm-hmm. We did develop a thing called the the School at the Center project in the 90s, which is a rural education project, I then became worried about what has become central in the divisions of American culture, that is the leaving behind of rural Nebraska. Mm-hmm. And so we developed a School at the Center project to talk about schooling as culture building in every respect, in writing, in history, in building of the history collections in the small towns, in economics, and building up the economic structures of the small towns, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. There's a part of that project called the Rural Writing Project, which comes out of the Nebraska Writing Project, and the School at the Center Project, which is headed at by Robert Brooke, and which continues with a fair number of schools and places. Mm-hmm. And you'd have to ask Robert Brooke, he's my colleague,
okay,
what goes on there in the way of research. That's the influence. Those are my answers to your questions.
That's great. Thank you. Thank you. You've been very generous with your time. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, well, I don't like to type, because I broke my hand and I can't. Oh. It's very unflexible, and also I make so many mistakes when I type. So I use a Dragon Naturally Speaking dictating machine to dictate most of my stuff, and it has a lot of mistakes in it. But I will answer things. I may answer them in ways that are aware of there may be mistakes because of the Dragon machine makes mistakes. But I'm willing to respond. My sense is that your colleague overestimates the influence that the Dartmouth conference had on the composition, but I could be all
wrong. It may be.
I would ask a bunch of graybeards that are important in composition whether they think that's true, and see if they to think of it in the same way.
Yeah. Yeah, I think, I mean, that's the goal. I'm also interested in getting some more diverse voices too about what that influence is and where they see it, and, you know, whether this influence is potentially not just a positive influence too, for some of the reasons why you describe it there.
Well, Martin Luther King, Robert Kennedy and Martin Luther King were killed in 1968. Mm-hmm. And it was a time like this time, when it was impossible to speak about education without speaking about culture and race and colonialism and mm-hmm. and community. And so what I took away from Dartmouth, I took into that dark hall, and it helped me, but I wouldn't say that it was all. It wasn't everything that I had to carry with me.
Mm-hmm. And you did that work later then too.
Excuse me?
I said, and you did more of that work later too, right?
I did that work through from 68 through 76.
Yeah.
Most influential work I did was to head the Study Commission on Undergraduate Education and the Education of Teachers. Mm-hmm. And in that work, we assisted in setting up the Indian Community Colleges on the reservations and the Universidad Boricua, the only Puerto Rican university in the United States, and a series of work with the Black universities, et cetera.
Yeah.
That I think was, even though it wasn't well advertised, because the Office of Education was under Nixon at that time, and they were kind of ashamed of what I was doing. We still did got it done, and I think it was more important. Hmm. It's probably the most important work I have done. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, I don't want to keep you anymore. I know you're writing your letter, which is also probably more important.
Well, I don't know. We'll see. But
It's something concrete to do in response that, you know, might be important work.
Yeah. Okay. Well, if we're done, we're done. And I appreciate your, I think you do a good interview.
Well, thank you. I really appreciated talking with you, and I'm impressed at your memory. That's a long time ago.
You may find out that it's all made up, but I just invented it all. And
well, there's not a lot of other people to check you at this point.
It's surprising that there aren't people who haven't written about this thing more.
Well, you know, there have been a lot. I don't know if I shared with you the bibliography. I can share the bibliography that I've collected.
I mean, apparently they haven't written about the dynamics, the process very much.
No, they haven't. I mean, the most that I saw was one from Miller, James Miller, who wrote a piece that looks like it was just like something put out by NCTE, like a, you know, something about Dartmouth from one who was there. And he talked about, it's actually quite a humorous account.
He has a great sense of humor. And
yeah, it's, I mean, actually quite enjoyable to read, but he talks about the contentiousness a little bit there and the drinking. And
Jim died just a few years ago too. He was out here to Nebraska about 5 years ago, and his first wife died, and he married again, and he was talking about those days, but and he was wonderful. He was one of there need to be some lubricant for the machine, because the gears were grinding pretty hard, and he had his sense of humor helped a lot.
Yeah, that's that's the impression I got from reading his report, too.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
I really appreciate your time.
Yeah.
And I will, I'll send to you a transcript or a write-up of some notes just for your own, curiosity, if you'd like.
Okay. Take it easy.
Okay. Thank you. You too. Bye.